Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Julian Racklin. The renowned violinist is performing Shostakovich's second violin concerto in a series of concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at Holding Up, A New Prison Legacy. The new theatre piece, which opens next week, tells the true stories of men in prison and the families coping with their absence. The Painted Bride has been nurturing artists beyond the mainstream for nearly 40 years. WRTI's Susan Lewis takes a look at the continuing relevance of this home to alternative art. And we speak with those served by the Senior Artists Initiative, a not-for-profit organization that develops programs that provide recognition for older artists and help with organizing their life's work. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Violinist Julian Racklin last night played the second in a series of concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra. In an all 20th century program, he's the soloist in the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 2 in C-sharp minor. It's part of Racklin's year-long personal celebration of the works of Shostakovich, with performances of the composer's chamber works in Vienna and violin concertos with several major orchestras around the world. In 1983, at age 9, Racklin began studying violin at the Vienna Conservatory with Boris Kushner, while at the same time having private lessons with Pinchas Zukerman. 5 years later, having won a major pan-European young musician contest, Riccardo Muti made him the youngest soloist ever to perform with the Vienna Philharmonic. Unlike some, Racklin has made the transition from child prodigy to well-regarded adult musician. He has a well-established recital and recording career, and his chamber work has led to the establishment of an annual festival, Julian Rackman and Friends in Dubrovnik, which he curates. I met with Julian Rackman earlier this week, backstage at the Kimmel Center. Has there at any time been a point where, like actors, they sometimes wish the playwright was in the room because they have questions that are unanswered? With Shostakovich, is everything you need to know on the page?
No, not really. And I think it's also good because it's also the composer's wish to have the performer add his own interpretation, add his own ideas, his own philosophies to the piece. And I'm very fortunate to be working very closely with one of the great composers, contemporary composers of today, Krzysztof Penderecki. Actually, before going to New York for my debut with the New York Philharmonic, with Penderecki Violin Concerto, I visited him at home and we had the chance to spend a week together. And he made a total revision of this concerto, changing many, many things. I said, but why? He said, because the way you feel things, the way you feel tempo changes, it fits. It convinces me. And the only thing I want to be is convinced.
The piece you're playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra this week, the Shostakovich Second Violin Concerto, with a lot of concerti, there's almost a sense that the soloist could at times leave the room and go and get a coffee because there are large sections of the work that have the orchestra playing and no involvement from the soloist. That really isn't the case with this work.
Not at all. I have not even time to correct when my A string goes a little down to, how do you say?
Retune.
To retune it. There is absolutely no time for anything. It's a great concerto. It's very much in the shadow of the first, undeservedly so.
Is that perhaps related to the fact that it's a difficult piece to play?
It's not more difficult than Tchaikovsky or Sibelius or Brahms or anything. It's difficult to capture the right mood. The time of Stalin, the Shostakovich, everything about Shostakovich, it's about this time. And this is the difficulty. But it's not difficult if you, I mean, especially for me, because my roots are from there. But even if your roots are not from there, there is definitely, it's very interesting to go back to these times. You know, if you're interested in these times.
And do you think an understanding of that period in history is necessary to fully understand how to play this work?
Completely, yeah.
And how did you approach that yourself? You were born 5 years after Shostakovich died.
Yeah.
And certainly many years after this piece was created.
Yeah, but my parents, they were studying at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, where Shostakovich would also be. He would be there. Chain smoking with the students. You know, always insecure little man, little bit shaking, and totally paranoid in a way.
And rightly so in many ways.
Yeah. I go to St. Petersburg since the Iron Curtain opened. I've been going to St. Petersburg, to Moscow, to Russia, to my home, Lithuania, Vilnius. So I played chamber music with Shostakovich, with Misha Maisky, with Yura Bashmet. These were all great friends of Shostakovich. So, of course, unfortunately, I was born a little bit too late. But still, you can really get the essence of what these times represented. My grandparents, you know, they very much were suppressed under this terrible regime of Stalin.
Excerpt from Thursday evening's Philadelphia Orchestra performance of the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 2 in C-sharp minor. The soloist, Julian Racklin, with conductor Philippe Jordan making his orchestra debut. The final concert in this series, which also features works by Olivier Messiaen and Richard Strauss, is this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Each year, thousands of men and women are sent to prison in Pennsylvania. The crimes and court proceedings of convicted offenders may receive a surge of attention for a time, but the general public usually forgets about criminals once they're taken to prison. These inmates, however, are rarely forgotten by their families. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, a new theatre piece opens this week that explores the impact of incarceration on family life and continues a theatre company's 16-year-long mission.
The latest production of the theater company Tova is called Holding Up, A New Prison Legacy. Based in Philadelphia, Tova, which means good, is the Hebrew name of Taya Sepinuk, the company's founder and artistic director. With a dance background, Sepinuk was drawn to a career of creating theater about pressing social issues during the mid-80s. Wanting to expand the scope of her dance work, Sepinuk began using the true stories of people in her projects, with the narratives told by those who experienced the events. Her early productions dealt with topics like aging, homelessness, and racial diversity.
At that point, I said, you know, this work is really what I love. I don't know even what to name it, to call what it is that I'm doing, but I want to keep doing it. And so I started the company in 91. And a few years later, I realized that actually the name that I wanted to give to the work was Theater of Witness, because it's not regular theater, but for me it is about witnessing real people's stories.
Since 1991, the stories that Sepinuk has showcased have involved victims of crime, domestic abuse, poverty, addictions, sexual minorities, and a host of other topics.
It's been a range of issues, but always with people who have been at the bottom and have not had a voice, whose voices we haven't heard a lot in society and who I believe have so much to teach us.
The newest Tova production, Holding Up, was developed in collaboration with inmates at the State Correctional Institution at Graterford, Pennsylvania. These were men seeking to repair broken and fragile family relationships. They realized that victims of crime aren't only those against whom crime is perpetrated. All too often, family members of prisoners are also doing time. A series of vignettes, Holding Up, was designed to bring together the voices of both those in prison and their families outside. Because about half of the scenes in Holding Up come from men currently incarcerated, they must be played by others, although the men themselves will be performing their own works when the show eventually comes to Graterford. With involvement in a previous Tova production, Hakeem Ali is one of the men who will perform the stories of inmates. An ex-offender who spent 40 years inside, Ali says he can strongly relate to the show's depiction of the suffering that children in particular endure when a parent is behind bars.
There's a lot of anger and resentment. I've had one of my daughters to tell me that I wasn't a father, and she would never call me father. She'd call me dad because her grandfather, which is her mom's father, he was the father when she was going through things in school or whatever the case may be. When I was incarcerated, she went to him because I wasn't there. I mean, I can talk about this stuff now, but when I heard that and going through that period with her was really difficult. But that's the kind of things that the children are forced to go through because of their fathers not being around.
The pain and regret of prisoners away from family is another facet of incarceration reflected in Holding Up, says Cameron Murray, who just 4 months ago completed a 22-year prison sentence. Murray also portrays stories of inmates in the Tova show.
A lot of times, you know, guys come to prison young, and they really, you know, they're reckless to some extent, and they're kind of willing at that age to risk their own well-being in the pursuit of this, you know, idealized wealth or whatever. But they really don't think about the impact that it's going to have on the family if they get caught. A lot of the times what you were doing, even in your mind, you were justified by saying that you were trying to help your family. And then when you go to prison and you sit there and you realize not only didn't you help them, but the degree to which you hurt them, you know, that's really a devastating realization.
One of Tova's core values is a commitment to create art that helps promote social change, not only among audience members, but also among the storytellers themselves. Hakeem Ali looks back on the time he spent sharing, rehearsing, and performing in Tova's last show, Beyond the Walls, as a pivotal period in his life.
It was very therapeutic. It was very a healing process for me. It was a way for me to get rid of some stuff so that I could deal with my family outside of this group that probably wouldn't have happened if I wasn't a part of this production. So that was very beneficial to me.
A long hallway. So much noise. I see so many doors. Little windows that are too
Music and video also play a central role in Tova Productions, as demonstrated by this segment from Holding Up. It's a story from Annabelle Armenta about a visiting room in a prison. The pre-recorded piece is accompanied by dance.
Let me out! Let me out! Faces pressed up against the glass. Kids are mopping floors, laughing and yelling.
Much of the music for Holding Up was written and produced by Dan Kleiman. He's been involved with 3 Tova pieces, creating music, and improvising during rehearsals to provide creative inspiration while performers develop their work. Kleiman feels he can serve as a kind of musical medicine man.
I've played jazz all my life. That's really what I've done for a long time, but I've seen that this is a new vehicle that's very interesting to me for using music to help society. And, you know, quite honestly, I didn't think this way a few years ago, and it was really largely thanks to Tova and this experience that steered me in that direction.
Tova's Theater of Witness is unique. It's real people telling their own stories. For any given project, artistic director Taya Sepinuk might extensively interview 30 to 40 people to find maybe 7 or 8 great stories. Sepinuk says this is what makes Tova's work so powerful.
It's so authentic. You know it's real, and you know it. There's something different about watching people playing their own parts.
Sepinuk says it's the touching, personal nature of these stories, not so much the entertainment value, that gives a production like Holding Up the potential to be a catalyst for social change, both for those inside and outside the prison system.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Holding Up opens at the New Freedom Theater at 1346 North Broad Street in Philadelphia on Thursday. After its premiere engagement through February 25th, the production will tour prisons, theaters, schools, and community centers throughout the region. Many know Philadelphia's Vine Street as a busy highway leading from the Schuylkill River to the Delaware, connecting Route 76 in the western suburbs with I-95. But Vine below 6th Street is another world. Here, a short hike from Alfred's Alley on the northern edge of Philadelphia's Old City neighborhood, you'll find small streets and large one-time warehouses, now home to galleries, storefronts, restaurants, and residents. And nestled in the middle of the block between 2nd and 3rd, sparkles a cut glass and tile-covered structure. WRTI's Susan Lewis explores.
It looks nothing like its neighbors on Vine Street, and it is neither painted nor a bride. But Executive Director Laurel Raska says the name Painted Bride reflects the history of this unusual venue for visual and performing arts.
In 1969, a group of artists graduated from the Academy. There was nothing in Philadelphia at that time, so they each kicked in $10 and rented an old bridal shop on South Street. So Painted and Bride.
The old bridal shop became more than a gallery for painters, thanks to the open-door policy of the group's founder, Jerry Givnish. Lenny Seidman is a musician who's been working with the Bride since 1983.
One day a piano player came over and said, I want to play here. A poet came in, I want to read here. At that time it was a wasteland, but Jerry is a very, very accommodating and open. He wanted to give the artist a voice.
Executive Director Raska says the Bride became a multidisciplinary space, which continued when it moved to its current home in 1981.
It purposely bought a facility that could house all the different disciplines.
If you're in the neighborhood looking for the Painted Bride, it's hard to miss. A one-time elevator factory, its boxy shape now glitters in three dimensions, covered from sidewalk to sky with thousands of pieces of colorful cut glass, tile, and small stones. Its outside walls transformed into a canvas for Philadelphia artist Isaiah Zagar. His work is called, appropriately, The Skin of the Bride.
In addition to being our facility, it's a piece of artwork.
Lisa Nelson-Haynes is associate director of The Bride.
When you're turning off of 3rd Street, it's a huge surprise to run into something so fantastic in the middle of the block.
Unconventional art that delights and surprises is in keeping with what The Bride is all about. The mosaic on its outside is matched metaphorically by a medley of artistic energy on the inside, among its staff, in its programming, and in its interior design and decoration. Walk in the door and look up, and you'll see an unusual chandelier suspended from the ceiling, the work of artist Warren Muller. It's part shovel, rake, tricycle, rope, wire, and colored lights, among other things.
And it's called Work and Play, and it's about being an artist, and it's balancing work and play, and that's the experience of being an artist.
On the day we visit, art as play is also evident in an exhibition by origami artist Amy Kaufman in the Independence Foundation Gallery just off the lobby. Kaufman has created a colorful design on the gallery floor with hundreds, if not thousands, of tiny, folded, starburst candy wrappers. Budding origami artist Ari Trey Masters, visiting the Painted Bride with his mom, Bula Trey, interprets the work.
All they are like boats going on the top of Statue of Liberty or the sun or a flower. I probably could make it, but I don't really have the time.
But it's the first time I've been here.
First time Ari's been to the Painted Bride. So not the first time we've been here. We've been to other shows. And it's interesting, all of the shows that I've been here for have been shows that you wouldn't see anywhere else.
Presenting art that you wouldn't see elsewhere is a kind of tradition at this non-traditional venue. Series are presented in visual arts, dance, theater and spoken word, jazz and world music.
And then there's certain things that defy categorizing, and they're outside the bounds of those series.
Lisa Nelson-Haynes does much of the programming, complemented by what Lenny Seidman does in his role as curator of jazz and world music. Seidman says that his aim is not only to present new kinds of music, but to attract new audiences.
And that's always been a driving force for me, to bring everybody together, not only the artists on stage, people from all cultures, but to fill our audiences with people from all cultures.
The Bride is drawn to artists who are trying new things, works with meaning beyond mere entertainment. Creative interaction is sought not only with artists, but with the audience. The goal of engaging the audience is fostered by the cozy 250-seat theater, where the stage glides up to the first row of seats. After a performance, the audience is invited to stay around and talk, which they do, says Lisa Nelson-Haynes.
This past weekend, We had two performances, performance piece from Tel Aviv to Ramallah. And afterwards, the artist sat on the stage and the techs that worked on the piece sat on the stage and engaged in a Q&A after both performances. There was 130 people. Most of those people, maybe 10 people left, but most of the people were engaged enough to sit and really want to have a conversation with that artist about the experience they just had. They're not looking for that quick soundbite. They really want to be engaged.
Live performances are often augmented by workshops and gallery tours. Sometimes a local ethnic restaurant will bring in food to create better understanding of the cultural origins of the work being performed. This kind of programming reflects the Bride's continuing philosophy that art can play a role in social evolution, an idea Seidman says is now more relevant than ever.
I think we were on it right from the beginning, but in the last 20 years, the globe has shrunk so much that it's even more imperative to reflect that the world is small and that we're neighbors with many cultures.
In a day of sound bites and quick entertainment fixes, the people at the Bride remain driven by a sense that art is not just a product to experience briefly, but a way to create a closer sense of community, and that artists, even today, when sometimes it seems that anything goes, still need a place to be nurtured and encouraged to take that extra creative risk.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Painted Bride is open Tuesday through Saturday. Tonight, as part of its World Music Series, the Bride presents tabla player Sufala. She mixes modern and traditional Western instruments with the classic drum music of northern India. Old City's Cafe Spice will be serving regional cuisine.
Painter John Stobart once said, "In a sense, artists enjoy a potential for immortality that no one else has, not even presidents or the rich and powerful. Yet, naturally, that immortality only extends to the artist's work. For many families, inheriting their loved one's creations provides solace during a difficult time, but for these same families, taking stock of an entire life's work can be overwhelming. Artists spend a lifetime creating, and the number of works produced can be extraordinary, begging the question, what do we do with it all? When Anne Kaplan's husband, Jerry, a well-known artist and printmaker, grew older and became ill, the Kaplans realized they had never spoken about what to do with Jerry's work once he was gone.
I've talked with widows of artists who are faced with a big problem. And it's a very hard thing to deal with because it's kind of overwhelming to be faced with so much work if it's unorganized.
Like many printmakers, not all of Jerry Kaplan's prints were signed, making them more difficult to sell or donate to museums and galleries. When an artist dies, their art becomes part of their estate, but without an inventory of the work, it's difficult to appraise its value. Together, Anne and Jerry Kaplan gathered with other artists to discuss this issue.
He and I really both were involved in this at the beginning. He had Parkinson's disease. I knew, he wasn't going to get better. By the time we started these workshops, he had died. And so then I realized in a different way what artists were faced with.
After her husband's death, Anne Kaplan continued working with artists, their spouses, and art professionals to find a solution. And with the help of Philadelphia Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, Kaplan and Company created the Senior Artists Initiative, a non-profit group which assists senior artists in organizing their life's work. Each year, Philadelphia area museums and universities choose an artist to sponsor in the program. Museums partner the artist with a docent, universities with an art student. The artists, students, and docents meet with an appraiser who stresses the importance of an inventory. The appraiser then gives each artist a binder and has them fill out each page with a date, title, photo, and description of the work. Kaplan says some artists have initially been hesitant to participate, but they eventually come around.
I don't like to have this project seen as something to help artists prepare for their dying, because every artist who's worked with it has found that it's rejuvenating for them because they do discover things that they'd forgotten about and they feel acknowledged by going through this process.
At the end of the inventory process, artists choose some of their most significant works to document on video as part of an oral history. The student or docent takes on the role of interviewer, helping the artists discuss their life and their works on camera, recording not just the dates and process, another suggestion of the appraiser, but also the thoughts and feelings behind the work, making it possible for future generations to better understand the creative side of their predecessors.
Monica Sharon Kurdeman participated in the Senior Arts Initiative when she was a student at Drexel University.
I really found the greatest pleasure was seeing them have this excitement, telling me the stories behind each piece and what it meant to them and who they could give it to or how their friends perceived their work once they received it.
She's referring to Tina and Douglas Papajohn, a youthful couple who could be spokespeople for Aging Gracefully. The Papajohns are the only collaborative team to have been chosen for the initiative since its founding in 1996. Married for over 40 years, Tina paints and Douglas makes the frames for the paintings. Although working together, the Papajohns only started officially making art 15 years ago, but the video tour of their house of 40 years shows various handcrafted objects, and it becomes evident they have been collaborating for much longer. In addition to the work in their house, the Papajohns also have a studio stacked with their work, not to mention works in progress. Tina Papajohn says although their children are proud of their achievements, they don't need the burden of trying to figure out what to do with so much artwork.
Your children are not going to love every single thing that has come from your hand or spirit. When you're dead, they're going to say, oh, what are we going to do with all this stuff?
Fortunately, the Papajohn's children don't have to worry about this right now. Like many older artists, the couple is still making art. And as Tina Papajohn says, this too is good for people to see.
The Senior Artists Project was a very, very wonderful thing and a kind of a recognition of people still working in late in their life with dedication to something that they care about and love.
Students spend at least 60 hours with the artists, cataloguing, organizing and interviewing. For many, this has turned into an important side benefit of the program. Monica Kurdeman and the Papajohns are quick to express their mutual admiration for each other. In addition to helping them sort through their work, Monica taught the couple how to use their digital camera and their computer. Happy that she could be of technical assistance, Kurdeman stresses that the Papajohns taught her something even more valuable.
I never really feared getting older besides maybe physically. I feared more like I would lose some of my spirit, and I was hoping that through this I would gain more wisdom, which I definitely did, and it was kind of comforting to be around them because they have so much energy and they know so much about life.
And the Senior Artists Initiative is currently presenting a series of training workshops at the University of the Arts. More information is available at their website, seniorartistsinitiative.org. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Lauren Saul, Charles Gagnon and Mayuri Carmel-Holmes. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.